From Libya, dear listener, we travelled to the country's powerful neighbour, Egypt, which has long tried to meddle in Libya and has been a beneficiary of its energy wealth. My next guest believes that, like Libya, the Egyptian uprising is not really over. In fact, it will continue until Egypt is under civilian rule. And that's something the country hasn't seen since 1952. During a visit back to her home country, Mona El-Tahawi spent several nights in Tahrir Square to support a sit-in that called for justice for families who'd lost loved ones during the revolution and to insist that Mubarak stand trial. Columnist, researcher Mona is in Australia to speak at the Melbourne Writers' Festival and joins us from the South Bank studio. First of all, Mona, welcome. Before I discuss Egypt, I want to ask you a couple of questions about Libya. September the 1st, historic day in the Libyan calendar, isn't it?
It is indeed, because on September the 1st, 1969, a 27-year-old captain in the Libyan army called Muammar Gaddafi led a bloodless coup to overthrow the monarchy and to seize power in Libya. So had he still been in power today, it would have marked 42 years of Gaddafi rule over Libya.
Now, I've got a note here which can't be right. It says that you covered the coup for Reuters.
No, I was actually in Libya 15 years ago in 1996, covering the commemoration of that coup,
right,
which Gaddafi called a revolution.
Yeah, well, that makes sense, and I shall have the researcher thrown into a cell. If
this had been Gaddafi-led Libya, you probably could have.
It's probably a poor choice of a phrase. If memory serves me right, unlike some other military revolutionaries, Gaddafi didn't promote himself to the rank of general immediately upon seizing power.
No, he just went to colonel, so it was quite modest of him, I guess.
He accepted a ceremonial promotion from captain to colonel and remained at this rank.
Yes, his ego wasn't so out there running away with him, but 42 years of suffocating rule over Libya more than made up for him seizing the title of general, I guess.
The only parallel I can think is Colonel Sanders, who remained colonel. He could have become General Sanders, couldn't he, or Admiral Sanders?
He could have, but Gaddafi doesn't have a secret recipe, so there you go.
Now, before we move on to the situation in Egypt, you've done plenty of work with Middle Eastern women. What does a post-Gaddafi Libya hold for them?
Well, you know, one of the weirdest and most bizarrest things of the Gaddafi legacy is that he actually had the nerve to call himself a feminist. He would boast about the fact that he had this kind of legion of female bodyguards who we've now discovered were raped and sexually abused by him and the regime. And he would take these absolutely bizarre trips to Italy specifically, where one of his best mates in Europe, Silvio Berlusconi, would agree to round up Italian women for him so that Gaddafi could lecture them on feminism and claim to save European women from the injustices of gender inequality in Europe. So Gaddafi had the nerve, as I said, to call himself a feminist. And I think now that Libyans are systematically dismantling his regime, Libyan women can actually fully accept and take over that title and say, we do want a feminist lifestyle in Libya, because Libyan women do work as doctors, as engineers. Their life is nothing like that of women in Saudi Arabia, which unfortunately is often held up as the template of existence for women in that part of the world. So I think that Libyan women, having supported this revolution from the beginning, in many cases actually haven't driven it from the beginning, because when the revolution began in Benghazi in eastern Libya, Eastern European revolutions on the mind, women were very much involved and in the public eye. So I have a great deal of confidence in Libyan women that they will demand a central role in this revolution.
It suddenly occurs to me that perhaps Gaddafi embraced feminism at the end, because there's a story that he escaped the rebels by dressing up as a woman. And that would be...
Well, that's ironic, isn't it?
That would be delicious, were it the case. Now, Egypt, of course, is focused on internal issues. What kind of a relationship do you predict between the neighbours sans their dictators?
Well, you know, what we're seeing in the region now across the Middle East and North Africa is a true sense of that unity that our dictators claimed to have. And, you know, we would see the disunity that these dictators had amongst themselves when we would have things like the Arab League summits, where you would see someone like Gaddafi. It became a tradition where he would kind of be the clown of these meetings. And there was very little unity between these dictators. But what you're seeing now is a true unity in the sense that Tunisia inspired Egypt, which in turn inspired Yemen and Bahrain, which in turn inspired Libya, which in turn inspired Syria, and so on and so forth. And when you go on social media, especially, which have become these great tools of connection, you really do see that unity where activists on the ground in these respective countries send advice, send support, and send messages of solidarity to each other. So especially when you think about the young people in the region, and they are the majority of that region, 60% of that region is younger than 30, you really do see this future in which they definitely consider themselves as one people, but not in the way that their dictators did, in that they disclaim or try to disempower those who belong to minority communities among them. Rather, they see their solidarity as one and their fight against injustice as one.
Mona, a couple of nights ago, I was talking to a splendid woman from Israel who's been taking on the power structure there, and she was going back in the hope that there was going to be a mass march of young Israelis protesting mainly the tyranny of Orthodox religion. But and once again she was making the point that they were being connected, they were being in effect inspired by the new technologies. She'd given up on them. She thought that they were just acquiescing to shopping. And then all of a sudden, the example around the region inspires young Israelis to protest.
That is one of the greatest ironies in the region right now, in that you're seeing Israelis who, you know, are often on the other side of the political spectrum for many people across the region, feeling inspired by them. But I have to say, as an Egyptian, and as an Egyptian who's lived in Jerusalem to cover the conflict for Reuters News Agency many years ago, while I salute the politicization of a generation of Israelis that had long felt disaffected and marginalized from politics, I honestly cannot see their uprising as an uprising for true social justice until and unless they take on the injustice of the occupation of Palestinians. And while I recognize that this is a good start for this young generation of disaffected Israelis to embrace their politicization, it cannot stop at things like the, you know, rent is too high.
Well, and Mona, you're absolutely right. And when I raised the Palestinian issue with my Israeli guest, she would insist on changing the subject. She didn't want to focus on the Palestinian problem. She wanted to keep it on the fact that these kids were being radicalized by living in the neighborhood. But let's move on. One of the most chilling things you've said is that Egypt has replaced one Mubarak with the Supreme Council of Mubaraks, and in the form of the military hierarchy that currently runs the place. Is it as bad as that?
It is, unfortunately, and it's something that, despite my optimism, I have to point out, and many Egyptians point out, although they too are optimistic, because unless we recognize that reality, we cannot fight for the civilian rule that Egyptians long for, that Egyptians rose up for, because we've been under military rule since 1952. And what we essentially have now is this Supreme Council of Mubaraks, of men who grew through the ranks, who rose through the ranks of the military with Mubarak, who are sending to jail bloggers and dissidents and opponents in the way that Mubarak did, and who, ironically enough, are putting many more people on military trial than Mubarak ever did. So unless we look that reality in the eye, we will not know what we're fighting in Egypt, and we must acknowledge that the revolution continues.
Mona, I've been going to Egypt for 40 years. It's one of my favourite places on earth. And I must say, I did not detect what was going on. Did you see it coming?
You know, the revolution obviously didn't happen overnight. There have been many, many strands at work for many years now. But the one thing that over the past, I would say, 6 years had kept my faith in Egypt alive had been young people. And the reason that I focused on them especially is because in 2005, it was young people who inspired me to return to Egypt from the US for 4 months to join the street protests that were happening back in 2005 and directed against the Mubarak regime. And it was in watching how those young people who had been completely apolitical up until then organize online and find each other and go out and insist that the focus of their protests was Egypt and of making Egypt better. And I would go back to the US and say, I'm pessimistic about everything in Egypt except for young people and how they're rising up.
Did you notice a sort of a broad spectrum of Egyptian young people? Were there Christians as well as Muslims, for example? Were there secular Egyptians making common cause?
Absolutely. What was unique and very exciting about what was happening in 2005 was that it did cross all those traditional barriers that the Mubarak regime had used to keep people apart. So I got to know young activists, for example, who very much identified as leftist and communist in some cases and very secular, who were very good friends with young men and women from the Muslim Brotherhood, who were clearly much more religious and observant than they were and who definitely did not identify as communist. And they were able to cross those political and religious lines in ways that their parents couldn't. And I think this is one of the reasons that activated and inspired and galvanized the revolution that succeeded in overthrowing Mubarak, because you needed to get Egyptians of every walk of life out on the street. And we got up to 15 million of them out on the street, despite all their differences, but united in this very idea that we have to get rid of Mubarak.
You're listening to LNL on Radio National, Radio Australia, and various high-tech platforms. And my guest is the beautifully voiced Mona El-Tahawi. And we're discussing the latest situation in Egypt. How do you feel when you see those images of Mubarak in his bed, for heaven's sake, behind bars in court?
Well, my initial impression was that we should not have these cages for defendants, for anybody in a courtroom in Egypt. And I hope that free Egypt, post-revolutionary Egypt, will get rid of these awful cages. Now, I've met Mubarak many times because as a correspondent in Egypt, you know, I would cover a lot of his news conferences, and at various times he would call me the troublemaker from Reuters. So Mubarak and I have history. And, you know, while it is disturbing on many levels to see an old man in a cage like that, I, as an Egyptian, revel in the fact that we are putting him to justice. It's not about revenge for me or any of the Egyptians I know. It's about justice and it's about accountability. And it's about turning over a page in Egypt. It's about saying that this is a new Egypt in which corruption, in which murder, in which nepotism and dictatorship have to stand accountable to the people.
We've been very concerned and doing lots of stories on the London riots, and I was fascinated by a piece you wrote in The Guardian where you reminded the Brits that your Prime Minister is, after all, the same David Cameron who was the first foreign leader to visit Mubarak-free Egypt to say he was inspired by the protesters, but then spent the next 3 days touring the Gulf with eight of Britain's leading arms manufacturers eager to sell weapons.
Well, you know, I got to say the hypocrisy of much Western foreign policy is astounding and continues to astound me. And the reason that I wrote that column that you mentioned is because very soon after the London riots, David Cameron and other British officials and politicians actually talked about curbing social media and putting controls on social media because they claimed that social media were being used to fuel the riots. And I thought, what is going on here? Because when Mubarak talked about putting curbs on social media, he was roundly and rightly condemned for trying to interfere with our freedom of expression. So it's one of these many, many examples or instances of basically Western politicians lecturing dictators across the world, as they should, about freedom of expression. And yet when those very same Western and democratically elected leaders are challenged by crises, they all of a sudden speak in the same language of control and curbs. It's quite astounding.
Let's walk this back a little. During the uprising in Egypt, many of the tweets were saying that the Arab Spring was destroying the ideology of jihadism. Overly optimistic?
No, absolutely right. Because if you really think about it, Osama bin Laden symbolically died for many people in the Middle East and North Africa many years ago when he physically was killed by the Americans earlier this year. It was that kind of the physical manifestation, basically, of the symbolic death. And by that, I mean those young people, those young men and women who galvanized a lot of these revolutions across the Middle East and North Africa were not themselves galvanized by Al-Qaeda's message. Al-Qaeda's message was one of the only way that you can overthrow these unjust dictators is through violence. But when you look at the Egyptian revolution, when you look at the Tunisian revolutions, these were revolutions of non-violent protests. Syria and even Syria, when you look at the brutal crackdown that's happening in Syria, Syrians continue to leave their homes without any of their weapons. And I know many Syrians have weapons. So Al-Qaeda's message did not get through in the way that the message of nonviolent resistance to dictatorship got through. And that, for me, signals a complete and utter failure of the violence, the message, rather, of violence that bin Laden had promoted.
I'm glad you've been lured to Australia, Mona. I understand you're going to do quite a big circuit of our wide brown land, but at the moment, Mona is here to speak at the Melbourne Writers' Festival. And Mona, thank you for raising the issue of elderly gentlemen in cages. I hope management is listening and will let me out of mine. I've been broadcasting in a cage for 20 years because I worry them. Mona, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me. And if you want a revolution, I can arrange one for you.
Mona, how wonderfully exciting. Coming up, A Compassionate Bastard. We talked to Peter Mitchell, who sounds like a terrific bloke, about his time, would you believe, managing the Villawood Detention Centre, that hellhole for refugees, for asylum seekers in Sydney.